Mark Kriegel is one of the great reporters I have known. I've just met him, but in reading his books, I have come to appreciate that. He must think I'm the biggest idiot in the world. We must have exchanged like 8 emails, like, well, okay, it's 4:30 here. What time is it in California? Mark, sorry about the mix-up, but I'm an idiot.
Not at all, and you're not an idiot.
Well, thank you very much. Mark's latest book is Baddest Man, The Making of Mike Tyson. I'm going to keep him for the next 45 minutes because I want to know more about him, and I will read from this book. This is a riveting and haunting and enlightening book. Mark, where'd you grow up, please?
I grew up on 8th Avenue in Manhattan, a couple blocks from Madison Square Garden in mostly the 70s.
Now, that was a tough time. That was a tough time for Manhattan, I'll tell you that. Was it not?
It was an interesting time. I mean, look, I never thought I'd leave. I don't think I'd go back now. I live in L.A.
Yeah.
Which is not the destination I'd imagined for myself.
Well, life takes funny turns. You did not imagine yourself as a sports writer when you first... How did you get into journalism? Did you study it in school, in college?
No.
What'd you study? What'd you want to do? What'd you think you were going to do?
You know, half-baked notion I had was having something to do with playing basketball.
You were that good? That good?
No. I was that delusional. Absolutely not. And I went to a small school. The only place I knew I could play like varsity basketball as a freshman. I had some kind of like half-baked notion I'd go to law school.
Yeah. Did you play basketball on the courts that pepper Manhattan?
Yeah.
That was
now,
a good.
Of course, like if you're any good now, you never see asphalt.
Right.
The whole idea of the city game, and what those playgrounds and parks represented are different. Because if you're any good now, you know, an AAU team scooped you up before puberty or something, and you have private coaches and all the rest of it, and
you're taking care of from the time you're 10 years old, and then you become a millionaire.
Yeah.
You become a millionaire when you're 18 years old. When you were forced, Mark Kriegel, to give up the dreams of being a professional basketball player.
Can you imagine that?
Well, I could imagine it. Sure. Of course I could.
Hey, look, I don't want anyone to get the wrong idea. Like, I suck. Okay?
Well, as did I with my illusion of taking the place of Louis Armstrong, Louis Aparicio in the White Sox. When you decide,
I will say this.
Yes.
I will say this about basketball in New York. I did like literally two blocks from the Garden, two little blocks.
Yeah.
And my whole notion of New York, and New York is a sort of an enlightened city, was in fact tethered to the Knicks.
Sure.
Even as a teenager, and I came to I was never really a sports writer. My first stop in sports was as a columnist.
Mm-hmm.
I came to think of the Knicks as the leading metaphor for the downfall of New York.
That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing.
Friends all the time. It happened when Pat Riley was coaching.
Sure.
I don't know if it's too much sports for your show, but
the more the merrier. No, yeah.
But the Knicks, and I'm sure there are proper Chicago analogies. Maybe the Cubs when the Cubs became some sort of tourist destination. I don't know, but certainly when the Bulls shifted from Chicago Stadium to the United Center, whatever it is now.
That's what it is now.
But basketball was this cool New York thing, and the fans were discerning, and they were of every race and ethnic. It was New York. It was that unique mix that's New York. And then sometime like in the mid '90s and by the late '90s, it had shifted so much. It became like a place for like, you know, a hedge fund guy to get his picture taken with a rapper.
Yeah.
Like, show how cool he was. And I don't know if you know
the book written by a Chicago sports writer, a friend of mine named Rick Tellender, called Heaven is a Playground, which
I know the book.
Yeah, which really
I know the book very very well. I know Rick very very well. It was an incredibly important book to me growing up. I don't know if this is a graceless segue, but it deals a lot with Brownsville.
Oh yeah,
there's a ball player by the name of Fly Williams who has since been up and down and up and down. So I think he's away doing federal time now on a drug offense, if I'm not mistaken. But he was an extraordinary ball player. But he's from Tyson's neighborhood of Brownsville. And I remember, I don't know where I was in high school, college, I don't know, but passages that Rick gets in that book are so riveting. There's a genre about street basketball, which really the street basketball doesn't even exist anymore, really, for the reasons we said at the beginning. But to me, the genre starts with a book by Pete Axthelm called The City Game.
Yep.
But Rick's book, Heaven is a Playground.
Yeah.
To me, that was the high point of that school of literature.
Yeah, to me too. It's a remarkable, remarkable book. Yeah. How did you get into journalism? I know you were a cop reporter, general assignment reporter before you went to sports. How did you get into journalism?
Oh, oof.
Okay.
I thought I was going to go to law school. Like I had no idea. So I go through college, and I have really no idea. I just had this sort of half-baked notion I'm going to go to law school.
Yeah.
So I took a job in Washington, D.C., which is like you bide your time before you apply to some big law school.
Sure.
And I came home and I said, I'm going to write my novel. Like, I didn't know what the hell, I didn't know what a novel was. I didn't know how to write a novel. Rick, I swear to God, I didn't know how to type.
Well, I'm still a two-finger typist. I don't know if you are.
I had this book. I had my father's Olympia typewriter and a book, like literally how to type. And I taught myself how to type on his Olympia typewriter and took a bus from the Port Authority, like the bus station in New York, to some like busted out small Jersey paper in Patterson, New Jersey, where I would type obits, and if I was lucky, I'd get like a cop brief.
Yeah.
And then the next year I went to Columbia Journalism School. I was taking the LSAT.
Yeah.
I walked out of the test.
Why, too hard?
Yeah, probably. But no, I knew that the journalism was some sort of, I wasn't going to write my novel, at least not then. And
Can I ask Mark, what'd your dad do? What'd your dad and mom do?
My father was a teacher at City College.
What did he teach? Writing
in,
English
in Harlem.
Yeah,
English. He taught like American literature.
Oh, interesting.
Which today
interesting.
Would be demeaned as American male literature.
Yeah, of course. They wouldn't even have that class. He'd be canceled.
Yeah.
He would. Did he? Well, what then did he think when you said, Dad, I'm going to write a novel?
Oh, what are you kidding me? Stop.
He laughed. No. What did he say?
He's like, what? How are you going to make a living? And he'd always told me that if you're going to be a writer, which is exactly the reason why I did not want to be a writer.
Uh-huh.
If you're going to be a writer, have a salary job.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Be a carpenter, go be a fireman, go be whatever, be a teacher, whatever the hell you're going to be, right? But have a job, or you have to marry a rich person.
We got to take a break. Mark, thank you for staying on as long as you're going to stay on, because you're going to listen to some Chicago news. But I so want to talk to you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to spell Mark's name for you. It's Mark, last name K-R-I-E-G-E-L. His latest book is Baddest Man, The Making of Mike Tyson. I read this book and went crazy, wrote about it in the Tribune, then ordered Pistol, The Life of Pete Maravich. I'm now into Namath, a biography, and next up is The Good Son. And I'm afraid now, Mark, to order your novel, Bless Me, Father, but I think I will.
So I would be afraid, too.
I would think I will do it anyway.
Hey, listen, Rick, I'm going to give you special dispensation, okay? You're exempt.
Rick, really, you don't have to read
my
novel.
And all your listeners are exempt, too. Please, I hope you don't find it, okay?
Mark Rigo, I don't know how good a lawyer or a professional basketball player he might have been, but he's one hell of a, he's one hell of a sports writer. I will ignore it. I know you worked for the Daily News in New York. And the Post, and
when they were owned by the Tribune,
you're telling me
we went on strike against the Tribune. Should I say that? Is it okay?
Yeah, who hasn't? I mean, there went my profit sharing, which I never had in the first place. Yes, you were owned by the Tribune, and you wound up running a sports column, and you wound up having a your relationship with Mike Tyson that reaches a remarkable. Chapter now in the book, The Baddest Man, The Making of Mike Tyson. It did not start out in any kind of loving way. You used your column to tear into this character, didn't you?
I mean, look, by the way, it wasn't entirely without justification.
Of course. No. I'm not saying you were just mean.
I was, I got the gig by accident because actually it had to do with the Tribune. The News went on strike. The Post was about to go. I joined two clubs that were already dying, like newspapers and boxing. And no one told me at the time. But my first Tyson assignments were as a general assignment reporter, just running around the city. And which meant in those days of when crack was taking over the whole world.
Yep.
It was basically you're covering cops, you're covering murders in places like Brownsville in East New York, where Tyson is from. And a guy who at the time was really my closest friend, a guy I looked up to, a great columnist, a guy named Mike McAlary. He wrote a column about Tyson tries to kill self. When he ran his car into a tree, he was having a fight with Robin Givens.
Yeah.
And the Tyson camp took great exception with that. But when I look back on it today, and I'll get to the sports writing in a second.
Sure, that's okay.
It was all mixed up together, and it was a rush covering New York, because I imagine it would have been a rush for a young guy covering Chicago.
Sure.
And those or any other years, it was like you were just getting your first whiff of this drug.
Yep.
Which was newspapering and Deadline and all the nutty stuff that happens. But what I look back on it, I'm watching it, it's not just great tabloid stuff, but you're seeing the emergence of tabloid culture, I think.
Absolutely.
With Tyson, Robin Givens, Trump. And I was still covering basically cops at that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Tyson might have been one of the first guys to get me on the front page regularly. And some of it was riding the coattails of my friend, who was this great tabloid columnist, a real phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had written about basketball, I got some notoriety writing about basketball. The Post is losing all its sports writers to a buyout.
Yep.
The News, I'm on strike. I'm sitting at the bar drinking with the columnist and my friend who's an editor at the Post. He goes, I don't have a damn sports columnist. And it turns out it's just, and I'm riding high from these basketball
stories. Of course, of course.
And he goes, hey, give it to Kriegel. Give the job to Kriegel. I said, I don't want to do that. He goes, I don't really care what you want. He goes, all I want them to do is pick up the paper, turn it over to the back page on the subway, and go, I hate this kid. So I'm not exaggerating.
No, I know you aren't.
Really what happened.
I know you aren't.
So, and we were drinking at the bar, as you used to do when you put the paper to bed. So
yes,
that's
you
how,
did.
That was...
Yes,
that's
you did.
That's how I became not a sports writer, but a sports columnist. So of course, everybody hated me.
Of course. Of course.
Well, what is this kid doing in the sports section? He's never covered a ball game, which was all true.
I think it's a great break. And you know, and you are aware of the astonishing tradition of columnists in New York. Among them, I'm sure, heroes of yours like Jimmy Breslin. Heroes, and I think a mentor of yours, Pete Hamill.
Mm-hmm. Correct, yeah.
I want to ask you, Mark Kriegel, what is it, because it's always, it hasn't confounded me, but it's always intrigued me, why are some of the best writers in the world drawn to, I mean, Joyce Carol Oates, Norman Mailer, A.J. Liebling, why mm-hmm. boxing? Why were they drawn to boxing, and why did boxing bring out such, it raised their game too, I think. Am I wrong? Am I romanticizing this?
By the way, a Chicago guy who deserves to be mentioned there is a guy by the name of John Shulian.
Oh, gosh.
Wrote a column in Chicago for Wonder, and he was always drawn to boxing. There's a lot of answers to that, but I'd like to reverse it.
Go ahead.
Like I loved covering organized crime.
Who didn't?
Loved it.
Yep.
Okay. So I don't feel like after covering life and death stuff, I go into the Mets locker room and ask some guy, like, you know, why did he throw a curve with that count? And was his arm sore? It's like, you know, it's July. No one cares, right? Okay. But boxing, like, you need conflict or drama.
Uh-huh.
Boxing is ritualized, stage-managed conflict in which either protagonist, whether they're girls or guys, whatever.
Yeah.
What made them fighters in the first place almost certainly has to do with some dysfunction, some profound emotional dislocation in their past. And they bring all of that stuff with them into the ring. And again, it's stage managed. It's produced for television.
Absolutely.
Produced to be compatible with television, which is the American medium.
Sure.
And this has changed, and it's about to change more. But unlike, say, MMA, boxing has a past. Yep. And the pitch with Tyson, one of the great romantic notions about Tyson when he came on the scene, and why so many writers were drawn to him, was that he harkened back so conscientiously, the cell was, to that past. He was billed as the modern-day Jack Dempsey.
Yeah.
It was also the great
pairing with Customato, ancient trainer of fighters who was immensely quotable and was a archetype of some sort. Yes.
Yeah. It's a fair approximation when you hear his voice to think of Burgess Meredith and Rocky, for those
exactly.
who are not acquainted.
Exactly.
But I think this is to your point. Cuss was so good that he had, effectively seduced generations of writers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a great, I started out as a sports writer, became the quintessential magazine writer, Gay Talese.
Yep.
Was, you know, people study him in schools. His piece on, you know, Frank Sinatra had a cold.
Yep.
But the first great Esquire piece he does is on Floyd Patterson, whom Customato had made the youngest heavyweight champion in the world before he made
Mike Tyson
younger. Yeah. Okay. But in looking at the history of Cuss and Floyd Patterson and Gay Talese, I'm watching Gay Talese transform from a sports writer in the newspaper to something greater.
Yeah.
And to your point, I'm watching him become this as I'm reading his daily stuff and then his magazine stuff. I'm watching him become the great Gay Talese.
Yeah.
Same thing with Pete Hamill. His first piece for the New York Post was about Jose Torres, who was a fighter for D'Amato. So D'Amato had an almost theological sense of fear. He was, you know, some guys are great on camera. He was great in a notebook.
Yep.
He was fill up your whole notebook. But I think that it's not just about writers being drawn to boxing. I think that boxing made me a little bit better writer than I actually am. And the point about organized crime is, because I do want to button this up, is the beautiful thing for someone like me, not for the fighters. Okay, but boxing is where showbiz meets organized crime.
Absolutely.
So for all those reasons, like, how could you not want to cover boxing?
Yeah, yeah.
You want to go to the Mets or you want to go to a fight?
Yeah, you want to ask someone, why did you throw a curveball in the sixth inning there?
That, right, you know,
that's the greatest.
You know, my splitter wasn't working. Oh,
we got to take a short break. Come back. I want to ask you a couple of very specific questions about everybody thinks of themselves as, well, Mike Tyson was a child of the ghetto. The way you portray Tyson's growing up is not ghetto like. I know what a ghetto is. It's absolutely kind of dystopian. I want to talk about that, and I want to talk about the fact that I didn't know, and I certainly know a lot about this guy, that Michael Jordan for a while dated Robin Givens before she hooked up with Tyson. When you read Baddest Man, The Making of Mike Tyson, I don't know if it resurrects Mike Tyson as a admirable human being, but it does make him a human being rather than a caricature. And when you read in Mark's book where he came from, Bronzeville, a lot of people were all, well, he's a child of the ghetto. As I said before we came to this, it's a dystopian area. Mm-hmm. It's not a ghetto as anybody in Chicago thinks of a ghetto or anybody anywhere thinks of a ghetto. It's something like out of Mad Max without the cars. Terrifying. The fact that anybody gets out of there alive is an amazing thing to me. And and Tyson barely got out.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's also, and I covered I spent like about a year covering the homicide of a cop in a housing project out there. So yeah. I was familiar with the neighborhood. And one of the interesting things about it is these are the same streets that produced the old Murder Incorporated crew.
Yep. So, yes.
And along with more than a few fighters. So I don't know if it's something in the water there. I don't know what the hell it is, but it's always produced like great gangsters and great fighters. In Mike's time, though, it was in a way that the country came to think of the South Bronx when both Reagan and Jimmy Carter, you know, it was leveled. It was a landscape created by abandonment,
fires,
and
arson.
And this is not inconsequential. It's in one of these abandoned buildings where Tyson claims to have been attacked, molested.
Mm. Yep.
It's you know, victimized. It's central to his makeup, to his thinking, to what becomes of him, and how he's able to refract his fear, I believe.
Yeah, I think
onto
you're
others,
right.
Particularly opponents, but also in the middle of this like bombed out ruin, okay, someone has the great idea, we're going to stick the greatest concentration of housing projects outside the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So in retrospect, it's not easy to imagine to figure out what happened, but the kind of gang life, I don't know if everybody remembers the Escape from New York, which is kind of a goof, you know.
Yeah.
Or the Warriors.
Yeah.
Now, those are like gang movies, but they're not too realistic. It was that crazy, but it was real, and it was treacherous. And, you know, basically Mike was a gifted fighter. He found out by the age of, say, 9, he was good with his hands.
Yep.
And he certainly had the requisite, rage, but it was essentially nonstop criminality.
Yeah.
It wasn't the type of life where you could really trust anybody, but there are certain parallels between the street life and the boxing life. And one is that your reputation on the street, your reputation in jail, and your reputation in boxing are paramount. Because in any of those places, if people see weakness, they will exploit it.
Yeah.
They will, you know, and they will exploit you. So in a peculiar way, even though Cuss had this great gift of standing up to the bully, that was his theology that seduced all the writers, the irony is that his greatest pupil, Tyson, takes that fear, refracts it onto his opponent, and I'm getting stories in this book about professional American heavyweights, they're not all tomato cans, who are scared to come out of their locker room.
I know.
For a 20, 21-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And that, I think, was sort of without precedent.
There's never enough time. But one of the people who was not scared of him, and I think this is a very telling portion.
He should have been scared of her.
Well, I know. Robin Givens, I would be terrified of Robin Givens' mother. But one person, we've never talked about this, Rosie Perez, who's from sort of the same neighborhood, she's at a time when everybody in the world was saying yes to Mike Tyson, no matter what he was asking. Mm-hmm. She said no. And she tells you interviewed 100 people for this book. She says, when you grow up with childhood trauma, you don't get to be a child. I saw that in Mike. I saw the abused kid, really just a good kid who got damaged. I saw the dented can. You know how people say game recognizes game? Mm-hmm. Well, damage recognizes damage. That is but one of the amazing quotes and people interviewed in this book. I've got to believe, in a kind of selfish kind of way, that this is... You didn't want to write this book in the first place. I know that, mm-hmm. Mark Kriegel. But this has got to be the first of a two-part triumph.
Well, that's the plan, because I got a really good Rosie story for the next one too. I just want to add that one of the things Mike, one of the unfortunate consequences of the way Mike is brought up, and it's to set, I argue, to make Customato live forever, to make him immortal, and mm-hmm. to make Tyson immortal, which is not like the usual thing. You get a kid out of lockup, you say, well, put you in the Golden Gloves, and maybe get you a GED. Mike, from the beginning, it was, you're going to be the greatest of all time,
youngest and greatest.
Hey,
yeah. Yeah.
Kid, make me live forever. But as a consequence of that, everything was okay. The word Mike never hears is no. And that's a real problem when it comes to women.
Ugh.
I have actually great admiration for Ruth Roper, Robin Givens' mother.
Yeah.
Because as tough as she is and as treacherous as I think she can be, she is a self-made woman at a time, a single black mother. I understand why she came out the way she did. With the exception of Don King, I think she's probably the toughest person in the story. But to your point on Rosie, Rosie had been an abused child too.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike hits on her, and he's used to whenever he hits on a girl, the girl is just going to be compliant.
Sure.
Right. But this is the problem with how Mike has been essentially raised or not raised. And Rosie turns around and shuts his you-know-what down.
Yep.
Like, yo, get out of here.
Yeah.
Shuts him down, and he kind of, like, skulks off.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, he's like the wounded kid.
Yep.
And
she was very moved by that, by his being,
yeah,
showing the wound.
Right. But I said, how did you know? Because a lot of other women would have, like, well, I don't know. But how did you know that you could just, that you could do that with him? And then she... And that's when she went into the explanation. She goes, hey, game knows game, damage knows damage. I know him from the jump.
Mark, as you know, I feel this is one of the most remarkable books I ever read. I may just take a wild leap.
God bless you.
And read your novel, too. Mark Kriegel is the author. I'm spelling it for you, ladies and gentlemen. Mark, Kriegel. I've read his book on Pete Maravich. I'm moving on to his book on Joe Namath, and I'm moving on to anything you write, Mark. I hope you come to Chicago one of these days, and we'll get Rick Tellinger.
I hope so, too. We can get a drink
we'll
or a meal.
All our sport. Yeah, we'll get some drinks. Mark, it's a pleasure to know you. I'm sorry we don't have more time, but ladies and gentlemen, go out and read this book. You will not be disappointed. Maybe about boxing on the surface, but it's about life and death and humanity. Baddest Man. Mark, thank you.
It's absolutely my pleasure, Rick, anytime.